seems most reasonable, as we discussed when this first thing first came up, that maybe nationwide regional primaries would be far superior. And in that case, if the regional for Northwest was X date, then they're in the region anyway, and there's chances of jumping up here to Alaska and visiting, because then it would be 1 in 13 states or 1 in 10 states, and they'd be sure to jump up here and get Alaska's voice. So that's in my mind when I think of this primary that we're considering now. Do you know how many candidates who have met the following deadline for this current election, proposed election? How many met the deadline?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my guess would, you'll have to ask Lieutenant Governor that question specifically, but my guess is that all of the Democratic contenders, for instance, have met the deadline for the simple reason that under the law we passed, I think very wisely, the contenders don't make the application. The Lieutenant Governor, in his judgment, puts a spot on the ballot for everybody who is an announced candidate. That way people, all of the contenders, know they have to come to Alaska if they want to be, if they want to be considered, and they can't say, sorry, Alaska, I'm not coming, and then avoid the embarrassment of a bad showing. Under our law, and I think it's a good one, and it's the way it is in several states, it's not up to them to say whether they're going to be on the ballot or not. They're going to be on the ballot if they are a nationally announced candidate. I'd like to go back, if I could, to your question about the regional primaries. If you look on this thing I printed out to you, you'll see that instead of going the regional way, now, under our law, again, a good decision, the primary is called for in April, except that we very explicitly gave the authority to the Lieutenant Governor to set another date. And there's two reasons for that. Obviously, he wants to set the date that's most advantageous for Alaska. And the advantage could go in two different directions. If we wanted to bunch our election around, for instance, Washington, Oregon, California, or something like that, and have sort of a quasi or ad hoc regional time, Lieutenant Governor could have gone that route and planned it, in, say, the same weekend as Washington. He didn't do that, and I think he chose the right path to take. Instead, he chose for our election to be the first presidential primary in the West, that March 13th. And that will give importance to Alaska far in excess of our, small number of delegates to the national convention. I think it was an excellent choice. It makes all the sense in the world. As I say, he could have gone the regional route, and sometime perhaps that'll make some sense. But in this case, I think it was a far better choice to set our primary on March 13th when several other primaries are being held, but if you'll notice, all of them are in the East.
East and South.
Yeah. There's no other primary than in the West, and there hasn't been any in the West. All of a sudden, that gives Alaska an importance, not really comparable to the New Hampshire primary, which is the first in the nation, but in that general vein, and all the more reason why it is absolutely ridiculous for us to be giving up that advantage, and just wiping out the entire process. So I thank you for bringing up that point, which I had forgotten to mention in my initial presentation.
Representative Kusendorf.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Miller, I supported the present law, which is now on the books dealing with the presidential primary, and I supported it for the same reasons that you're giving here before us today. But I find kind of an interesting thing happening in my district that those that are party regulars don't like it for obvious reasons, and those that are independent don't like it because they feel they have to make a party choice. And my thinking was much like yours, that it would make the process more democratic, but it appears in my district that it doesn't appear to be what my public is looking at.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just repeat what I said earlier. Nobody is getting any less than they have right now. Right now, the independent voters that you're expressing concern for have zero, zilch, no input into the process at all. Under this, they have the opportunity to make a decision, a conscious decision, whether they want to participate in the political process. Some of them will decide that they want to stay independent, they're proud of being independent, they don't want any part of it, and they'll not participate in the presidential process. A lot of people, I believe, and we wouldn't know this until we try it once, I think a lot of people are going to say, well, I've never declared my party before because there's no good reason. There's unless you want to run for the House of Representatives or the Senate, there's practically no reason at all why you should declare yourself either a Democrat or a Republican. There's not a single advantage to doing that.
Well, Representative Miller, had we been able to have a closed primary and truly make it a party election, we probably wouldn't have these problems. But because of the independent, the number of independents in this state, we had to make it kind of a wide-open blanket primary, and thus we run into problems.
Yeah, well, my guess, Representative, is that if we keep, if we stay the course, if I could come up with a brand-new phrase, and if we stay the course and let this take place, I think we'll find that for the first time, more people are registered Democrat or Republican than are registered independent, because there'll finally be a reason for a person to declare himself or herself more or less aligned to one party or the other. I think this could be the first step in taking the very sick and ineffective party level of consciousness that exists right now and raising it up a little bit. And I think that the experience will be that this could be the best thing that's happened for the two-party system in Alaska since that tragic day a decade and a half ago, or whenever it was, that we abandoned the what Nick Begich used to call the Alaska primary system.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This being a finance hearing and having sat here for the last half hour or 45 minutes listening to others coming talking about various budgets reminds me a bit of a story, and the story goes something to the effect that a wealthy gentleman was walking along Madison Avenue and pitched three pennies into a beggar's cup. The beggar looked down at the three pennies and said that it too reminded him of a story. He said, in the first instance, I see that you're a frugal man. With the second penny, I see that you're a bachelor. And with the third penny, I see that your father was a bachelor, too. The moral of the story, as it were, is that in this instance, and perhaps looking back to the time when the primary was established, Alaska felt, or the legislature felt, that Alaska was in a position that it could spend $1 million for a pilot effort. If you look at the statute itself, it's self-repealing after this year. There are no more primaries. I would suspect that the political pressures would be far and away against you to reestablish the primary after this year, and if in fact it did go through. So it is a pilot effort, funded at a time when many were of the belief that Alaska had tremendous and long-enduring resources. I would submit that that is the single overbearing reason for not conducting the presidential party primary this year. Secondly, the legislature in 1980, when it passed the legislation, had no idea that in 1983, the Supreme Court of the United States was going to come in and change the rules. Ruling on a Wisconsin case, the La Follette case, the Supreme Court said that a state can conduct a primary in any fashion that it chooses. It can have, as Representative Miller mentioned, any of a number of approaches to the delegate selection process. But the court said that if a state is going to conduct a binding primary election, then it must comply with party rules. And that's where the problems have come in, and problems that are inherent in the legislation for the Alaska primary. Under party rules, we cannot allow independents to come in and vote as independents. We have to limit, if we're going to conduct a binding primary, access to the ballot to members of a political party. It's facetious to think that we're opening up the process or liberalizing the process to allow more of the electorate to participate. If in fact you're a member of the Republican or the Democratic parties, you can participate by attending precinct caucuses, by attending district caucuses, and by attending the state convention. If you're not a member of those political parties, then of course you can't. But under the structure of a binding primary, nor can nonpartisans or independents participate in the election process. They're banned from the ballot box as equally as they're banned from the precinct, district, and statewide conventions. That's the problem that we face. That's the problem that that sticks in the craw of the independent voter in this state. They have felt for a long period of time that all ballot access was going to be open despite political party. Some of the complaints that we're receiving is, why are we spending $1 million to conduct a party primary? If, in fact, the political parties want to have a primary election, why shouldn't they fund it? Why are we spending $1 million of the state's money to accomplish that? Now, of course, the countervailing argument is that every other state does this. Indeed, the 31 states that Representative Miller alluded to all spend state money to conduct, in essence, party primaries, except those who conduct beauty contests. And I think it boils down to one statement that's been very keen over the last several years in Alaska. And it's a statement that I'm sure if you expressed it in the terms that I just did to the nonpartisan voter, the retort would be, we don't give a damn how they do it outside. Alaskans cherish their independence. It's a responsible independence. But at the same time, it's an independence that rubs opposite a United States court and United States Supreme Court ruling. The rules as they're established aren't rules that I wanted. You'll recall that the rules that I had initially would have allowed the independent voter to come in, select that party ballot, and vote that party ballot without having to change their registration. It's that change in registration that has created the problem, and I think it's that change in registration that is going to keep the vast numbers away from the polls. Those who do show up and are nonpartisan voters are going to change their party affiliation only to turn around the next day and change it right back to nonpartisan, increasing the cost of the election. I think that in 1980 it was a noble effort done with the right intentions, without the expectation of the 1983 Supreme Court opinion, but given the facts that we face today, I think that it's a noble effort whose time has long since passed.
Thank you. Representative Lindauer.
Could you clarify something for me, Mr. Lieutenant Governor? It seems to me, didn't you just say that it was your decision that people would have to re-register? What is the real requirement that we have a binding vote? Why can't we have a general election?
Because that's not what the law says, Representative Lindauer. The law requires me to conduct a binding primary election. It's because the election is binding that the Supreme Court ruling, United States, La Follette versus the United States, comes into a play. Because, again, we can conduct any kind of election we want. But if, as the statutes in the state of Alaska suggest, we're to conduct a binding election, then we have to pay attention to the Supreme Court ruling, which deals with binding elections and requires us to conduct them according to national party rules. The statutes very clearly indicate that I have to run a binding primary election.
Well, why aren't you in here withdrawing the word binding, asking for that amendment as opposed to the repeal of the whole bill?
Well, I would assume that if we're going to ask for the citizens to select the delegates to a convention, and that they're going to presume that those delegates are going to go to the convention and vote according to the way that the citizens voted in the election, that you would have a binding election. If you had a beauty contest or an advisory vote, as many states do, I would be even more against it than I am today, simply because you're wasting $1 million. There's no obligation for the party to vote the outcome of the election.
Well, many states seem to find it quite admirable. The other argument that the representative made preceding you was that we would at least get the national attention as opposed to spending the millions that we spend to bring up cheap labor here to work at bellboys and things under the guise of tourism advertising. At least this way we get a shot at the national leaders instead of cheap labor. Why aren't you in here suggesting moving binding and maybe changing it to February 28th? If it's legitimate that we get their attention and things have changed since that time and you're in charge of elections, couldn't you be suggesting that we actually accomplish something by... it was a good idea 2 years ago. Maybe it'd be still a good idea if we adjust it to the current situation. If everybody's moved theirs forward, why don't we move ours forward a little bit?
Well,
we get about the last shot at them.
Everyone hasn't moved theirs forward, and the reason that they haven't moved theirs forward is because the political parties have both indicated that New Hampshire will be the first primary, and that no primary conducted prior to the New Hampshire primary will be binding on the convention delegates. So all of the binding elections come after that. Again?
You're using the word binding.
Well, and again,
somehow that's a magical word. I don't see
it. It's not a magical word, Representative Lindauer. It's a word that perhaps not yourself, but the legislature saw fit to put into the statutory scheme. I am bound by that as much as I'm bound by any other law in this state.
Mr. Chairman, it just seems to me that if we have an opportunity here, it's not an all or nothing thing. Surely we can be flexible and adjust in such a way as to accomplish whatever we wish to accomplish. If we wish to accomplish getting the attention of leaders instead of cheap labor come up here, maybe we should consider moving it up to the 28th of February and moving the word binding as an alternative to eliminating this thing, and then maybe reducing the tourism budget by $1 million to pay for it. We'd probably get more mileage by putting $1 million from tourism into this thing, and we'd certainly attract a different group of people. Might spend some money up here instead of come up to Taken.
If I may respond, Mr. Chairman, if you can't get candidates, that Representative Lindauer, to participate in an election that is presumably binding, I think the chance of getting them up for a beauty contest is much less likely to succeed. If, in fact, you just want to get them up, you could pay their plane fare and give them a $100,000 campaign contribution and save yourself about $700,000, if that's all you're trying to accomplish. So, again, I think that is a worse choice than the repeal of the process.
I would merely submit in closing that sounds like our tourism budget, but, Mr. Chairman, I defer to you.
Representative Ward?
Thank you. If I understand why this has come to be, and from my discussions beforehand with the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, is that they refused, or they not only refused, but they said they would not go back to the national level to try to change their platform to adjust into a primary vote in Alaska. And I know that both the parties, or all three of the parties, one of them have not even decided to play the game, but the other two have rules as such where the reason that this originally was put on the ballot is to do away with the fact that delegates could do whatever they want to without participation from the people, regardless of party to choose it. But I just have one, the question that I have is this, and I think Representative Lindauer brings up a proper question, and the presidential party primary election, I have to assume that you went through this in the spirit and the mind after the decision came out of trying to sell it to where it would be able to be utilized by all the citizens of the state. And if you can just respond to that, because I have to assume that it wasn't, that you couldn't find any way to make it to where everybody was going to feel like they are participating in the process. And since I've never heard it other than myself, I just determined in my own mind it couldn't be done. I'd like to know from you as Lieutenant Governor how you arrived at the conclusion that it could not be amended or altered to salvage the entire thing.
Okay. Initially, we looked at the statute, of course, to determine what kind of an election we had to operate in. And again, the statute dictates a binding election. From that, we said, okay, if we have to have a binding election, what are the rules that we have to follow? Given the La Follette decision, we have to follow. We cannot conduct an election in conflict with national party rules. I'm not sure what would ever happen if you had national party rules that were just the opposite of one another. I guess then we wouldn't be able to conduct an election that would be binding on anyone. But the next step we took was to say, okay, let's look at the national party rules and see how far we can go to include the majority of the electorate in the process. And in doing that, the parties have a rule that in order to, that those who vote have to be members of the party. So you look at the definition of a member, and there are those people who have publicly declared and signed saying they are members of the party. With that, I felt that on election day, all we would have to do is have the voter walk up to the booth. They would ask, which ballot do you want? They would say, I would like to vote the Republican ballot. Fine, they've declared Republican. Sign here. They publicly sign in the register under the Republican register. We would hand them the ballot and they would go. And that we wouldn't have to change everyone's registration, because again, it's that change of registration that adds an additional administrative headache, especially when we know full well that the majority of them are going to turn around and go right back to nonpartisan, or at least it's our estimation that they will do that, adding an additional cost. So we felt that last thing, the change of registration, was something that we did not want to have to do. We checked this out with both the Republican and the Democratic parties. In the meantime, the Libertarians had all gone to convention and had selected their party candidate, so there was some serious question of whether they even belonged in the primary, because it's, again, a primary to select candidates for nomination to the office of president. They've already nominated theirs. So given that, and having checked with both of the parties, they both indicated that, no, we will not be bound by that process. If you do that and you fail to change the registration of the voters who participate in the election, we will send our delegates back to the convention according to the caucus vote, and that's how they will vote at the party convention. So then we went back and restated the rules to allow that change in registration, which was the final thing that brought us into compliance with the party rules. having brought us into that compliance, they both agreed, or at least through their executive officers, agreed that they would be bound by the election that was conducted. So now you're in a position where you have the parties bound by the election, but you do so at the risk of offending all of those who are voting or who are registered nonpartisan, because in fact, if they vote, their registration will be changed to reflect the ballot that they selected on election day.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, to follow up, that was my understanding too, and I place the blame on this, blame if that's the proper word, not upon the Supreme Court ruling, but on the fact that the national parties were not willing to recognize that there is an independent force out there that represents well over half of the entire state, and also the United States as a total, and that's where the problem is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify?
If not, thank you. Is there any amendments? At this time, the chair will entertain a motion to move out House Bill number 430, an act repealing the statute that requires a presidential party primary election providing for an effective date. It also has a fiscal note attached to it, dated 1-16-84. Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that House Bill number 4.
We only have one subcommittee today. Is Fish and Game here? Is there anybody from Fish and Game? If not, Fish and Game goes to subcommittee. House Finance is adjourned.
The two overviews this afternoon would be education and natural resources. And Dr. Reynolds, you're on first this afternoon. We'd like a budget overview, not only on your operating budget, but also on your capital budget, and just the highlights, that would be fine. Would you and Allison, please state your name for the record, please?
My name is Harold Reynolds, Jr., Commissioner of Education.
I'm Allison Elgee, Special Assistant.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have an outline of what we want to say, which may be very helpful to you, particularly in light of the pressures that your committee is under in terms of time. And we also have a summary statement of exactly what it is that the governor's budget contains. And in that way, we can come pretty quickly to the point of where there are increases and what's the cause of the increase. I think that may be useful just by way of analysis. I'm going to talk from the Department of Education outline there, which has K-12 support on the top, Mr. Chairman, if that's all right.
That's fine.
And you can speed me along or slow me down in whichever ones you want. I'd like to make a couple of general comments as we begin. The important one, I think, for you all, and I'm sure you understand it better than anybody, but I'd like to make it just for the record anyway, is that the Department of Education budget is predominantly a pass-through budget. It's an employment budget for the rest of the state, in effect. If you look at that total at the bottom of the FY85 column, governors, in the one which contains the actual figures of the two pages that Allison provided, you'll note that that we have a request in under the governor's budget for $612 million, not counting the capital outlay. And of that $612 million, $600 million of it is virtually straight passed through. And about $12 million of the $612 million goes to support what would be called the traditional kinds of things that departments of education do. You all know, I'm sure, from your own communities, how well that the big figure, the biggest pass-through, is the $536 million of K-12 support that we're talking about. So with that kind of perspective, that of $612 million, most of it is passed through making jobs, local areas, for those engaged in the business of educating the young and the older people in the state. The first statement I want to get into before we look at those figures is about the business of K-12 support. We see the function of the Department of Education as basically responsible for encouraging, increasing, improving, technically assisting local school districts to improve student achievement. And as long as there is a State Department of Education, which is anything more than a simple pass-through, that is just an agency which puts out dollars as directed by the legislature, we will continue to make every effort we can to assist our local school districts to improve the quality of their educational opportunities. That's my statement on K-12 support. We have a way of going about that I can take a moment or two of the half hour I've got here to identify. We are going to be building profiles of school student achievement by school. We have the capacity to do it, but we have not done it. We've not done it for a reason that we can get into it another time if you'd like, but we have that capacity, and that means that we could go throughout the state when we have those profiles and say, School X has this profile of student achievement, School Y has this profile. The Department of Education would never do it for odious or pejorative purposes of comparing one school against another, but rather because if you don't identify what the problems are in the given school, how do you begin to address those problems? If a newspaper, other media, somebody else wants to make contrast, this is a good school and this is a bad school, we'll not be party to that, but the information will be there. And the point of doing the profile of the school, then, in terms of student achievement, is that we can then lay out a prescription for how to improve it in conjunction with a local school district and that local school. We can then proceed to the business of providing the technical assistance, and on an annual cycle, that three-step process can improve student achievement, we believe very strongly. And it's that kind of direction we're going with the smallest amount of our available funds. That is the support, if you want to use K-12 support, what the state does out of the Department of Education. But let's look at K-12 support now in the figures and get started down the column of figures. The other part of K-12 support, and the fundamental part, is the foundation program. It is up by $46 million in this request. I'm rounding those figures, but approximately $46 million. Why is it up so much? In your outline, there are four reasons for it. They come under the foundation program heading, and they are, just to say them, transfer of on-base schools from the state contract programs. We're picking up 9 new BIA schools, which means additional young people. Our enrollment growth is approximately 4% urban and 1.5% rural. The effect in the Anchorage area is considerable, as you know. There are reportedly 500 new residents in that general area every week. If that's the case, then in a normal population distribution, that would be 125 students a week coming into that area. Whether those figures are true or not, I don't know, but that's what we're led to believe. And the fourth part of the $46 million increase is the adjustment, the 4% adjustment in the cost of living index. That's part of the present bill. So there then are four specific reasons which account for the $46 million increase in the budget, the bulk of our increase. New programs, coming down my little list there, and perhaps moving quickly, but if too quickly, why we'll come back if you want, Mr. Chairman. The opening of Sheldon Jackson Museum will require 3 positions. In our capital budget, proposed by the governor, you will find that he has proposed an additional $2 million to continue with the purchase of the Sheldon Jackson Museum collection, a real world-class museum collection. $2 million has already been appropriated. $2 million is requested for this coming year, and an additional $2 million will be necessary to complete that purchase. When the purchase is complete, it may be one of the best bargains that the state has ever entered into because of the extraordinary quality of that collection, much of which has remained in boxes and isn't even available to be seen. When we do open Sheldon Jackson Museum again, we will need the 3 positions, and they are included in this proposed budget. Expanded services. We have a fisheries technology program to be run out of Seward. Seems entirely appropriate within the framework of economic development in the state that such a program be available. And, of course, recent successful fishing seasons would indicate that this kind of employment will be growing, and therefore this is an expanded service in the vocational area. I made some references already to this departmental focus, which appears at the bottom of the page, but I didn't want to start by just talking money at the head of the page, because the money is absolutely crucial, and it's your critical concern. But what happens with the money is even more important, and there, I think, just to run quickly over those, we want to provide the improved services to school districts along the line that I was citing at the beginning. That is, the school profiling and the development of the notion of a merit school. A merit school being a school which achieves substantially the student outcomes, and substantially means something on the order of 90% of the children are at least at grade level or better. Some of our school districts can say that. The one that I've customarily used, and some people think I'm being offensive when I use it by not mentioning some of the others, the only reason I use it is it's such an extraordinarily clear example, and that's the Annette Island School District, or Metla-Katla, which has had such an extraordinary development in the last 5 years from a student profile of achievement at the roughly 35th percentile level to the point where they're now up above the 65th percentile. That's a school and a school system which deserves to be called a merit school system, because all of the children are achieving at a level commensurate with their age and their abilities, or at least almost all of them. I can't say all of them, a great many of them. Coming then to the other focuses there, the technical assistance fits what I've just been talking about. We are in the process, and will have for this committee and other committees of the House and Senate next year, a new foundation program. We're on a temporary foundation program, as you all know well, at the present time. That foundation program will have to take into consideration a series of policy matters, and ultimately the legislature will be the judge on these matters. We will need some orientation to new funding mechanisms for the foundation program, and that will be part of our preparation during the coming year. The C item under department focus, improved cost efficiencies in district operations. The other part of our profiling, talked about student outcome profiling. Bill Thompson has returned as the director of the Division of Management, Law, and Finance. His skills are in the finance, cost effectiveness, efficiency areas. And we intend to do a profile of each school district, indicating how much is spent for transportation, how much is spent for administration, how much is spent for, and how it's spent, how effectively it's spent, so that we will have a district profile by the end of this coming year of each school district. And based on that, we can be offering, not on a mandate basis, but on a model or exemplary basis, suggestions to local school districts as to how they might better accomplish with efficiencies the use of the funds that they've got available. Finally, on the last, the lowest part of that page, problems experienced in FY84. There were two areas of major concern in the FY84 budget. Personal services were underfunded, positions in effect, and the travel reductions were very considerable. One of our problems, if we're going to do the school profile and then do the business of providing technical assistance, is that if you can't get the people there, then you're back to the level of telephone conversation or some other electronic media conversation, and that is not, in many cases, as useful as working face-to-face, hand-to-hand with people who are in need of some of those kinds of technical assistance. Enough then for the overview. I think I've spent about 12 or 13 of my minutes here. I think maybe in another 5 minutes I can run down the actual dollars, just pointing out what's pretty clear and trying to give some indicators of where the increased costs come from. And then Allison can review the budget, or I can review the budget with you, the governor's proposal for capital outlay. That was the other part of our assignment, I think, here today. First line, running across, you can see it's plus $46 million on K-12 support. I think I've explained the reasons. We've listed them A, B, C, and D right over there, and we can pin those down more precisely for your committee if you wish us to, by saying how much of the $46 million would be credited to each of those specific reasons. Management, law, and finance, I made reference to. There is an increase in that second line of $350,000, and that goes to the point of personnel or personal services, and travel. In the third line, data and word processing, as you know, the state is making some rather considerable savings in its word processing. I heard the Commissioner of Administration make some references to how significant those savings are, but one of the very important parts of this data processing, data and word processing, is that we still need an additional $250,000 for use in our capacity to provide those kinds of services. Next one, a much larger line, requires an additional $455,000, and that's in that education program support, and much of that comes under problems experienced in fiscal year 84, namely shortages of personnel and travel to accomplish the missions we've talked about. There's a $455,000 increase. Those are rounded figures. I know they're not precise, but I think they're close enough for our first discussion here. If not, of course, we can provide them, but you can too, just by reviewing them more closely. Executive administration is up by $74,000, and that has to do both with the executive administration in the department and with the State Board of Education. Although the next one says commissions and boards, this is related to a variety of other commissions and boards with which the department has to deal. But you'll notice that one is a reduction of about $105,000 in that one. Coming on, the Education Design and Delivery is one of our divisions, and that's a plus $117,000. That particularly has to do with Learn Alaska, which comes under that particular one, and also with our assessment program, which produces information about student achievement. Then we get down to to adult and vocational education, and there is an increase in that line of approximately $500,000, $550,000, and that is for the increased support for vocational offerings. Alaska Vocational Technical Center, I've made reference to the fisheries program, and then there are additional costs in keeping with the Seward operation, which will require this additional funding. I would digress, but I won't at this point, do that some other time, on the great success, again, on the long waiting list that we have at Seward for admission. We now have people who have paid a down payment on their educational program there who will not get in for at least a year in some of those programs, which means that that could be expanded more rapidly to try to meet those needs. But as you know, Seward, that vocational technical center, is driven by the market for employees, and as a consequence has a very high placement rate. I'm not advocating that we expand it rapidly to try to take care of all those who want to apply. I'm pointing that out in passing. And if money were to go anywhere, if there were ever any additional kinds of money, that might be a place for attention, particularly if we're concerned with jobs. Two more that we have concern with are vocational rehabilitation. There's a significant increase in that figure in the governor's budget. That, of course, has to do with the assistance provided by the state for those who are handicapped to make them more eligible for employment than they currently are. We have a couple of places that need attention. They only get attention now by people flying out to those areas, and that expansion of our capacity to provide services, I think, would be very helpful, and that is what accounts in part for those increased costs. I'll leave the Alaska Post-Secondary Education Commission to speak for themselves. They do not come directly under our purview in terms of administration, that is the Department of Education, although they're connected to our budget. Finally, Alaska State Libraries and Museums, plus a $600,000 figure there, and that is for a combination of things, including the support level for the Sheldon Jackson positions, as well as acquisition comes under capital outlay, the increased costs of operating those rather sizable institutions. Coming on down, that's, as you can see, an 8.8% overall increase. The bulk of the total amount of money, of course, coming in K-12, although the K-12 support foundation program does not account for the 8.8. Those other figures help to drive up that percentage of increase figure. But overall, it's an 8.8 increase, and justified on the grounds that we will be getting into, I'm sure, when you get closer, get to scrutinizing the budget a little more closely. The objects of expenditure we've listed, I don't think there's any need to spend much time on those. We'd be glad, or Allison and I will try to answer any questions you've got or get you answers there. But you can see, roughly speaking, how those dollars actually break out. The grants and claims, you can see, is $575 million. That's further corroboration of my initial point that we are fundamentally a pass-through agency providing funds for other agencies to employ and to run various kinds of programs. Our resources this coming year are listed then in the lower section of the paper. Our resources include an additional $3.8 million, roughly speaking, from federal receipts. These are known figures. There is some possibility of some small additional increase in some of those, since the mood of the Congress in an election year is to provide better funding than the administration's proposed budget. So it's possible that that could conceivably go a little bit higher. The general fund increase, the one you're perhaps most concerned with, is $44 million. And as you can see, that's roughly speaking entirely encompassed by the foundation program. Interagency receipts, slight increase. Program receipts is a slight increase. No change in the school fund from what we had last year, that is the cigarette tax. The donated commodity fee, I cannot at the moment explain to you. I just noticed it coming up here, why we have nothing in there in the FY84 adjusted base, but I note that it's about $30 million more than it was in the 83 actual. I don't know what, I don't understand why there was no base, but maybe Allison understands that.
In fiscal year 84, it was appropriated as program receipts, but I think that that was in error and it should be appropriated out of the donated commodity fee account directly.
So it's a small increase, and I think we probably got nothing more there than just the bookkeeping kind of concern. Public Law 81-874 indicates we'll get an additional 1.2 million, roughly speaking. The remaining one is just exactly the same. So our general fund percentage change is an 8.3 increase in the general fund, or about half a percent less than the total increase. So some part of this is being picked up by that summary from other funding sources. And finally, we look at the positions we've got. We had actual in 83, 499. We started with a base of 440, and we're proposing in this budget 446. You can see the breakdown on part-time and the very small change in temporary. And the one thing that's remaining, unless, Allison, there are things you want to add there.
The one thing I did want to mention on positions, so as not to mislead you, is that there has not been that considerable reduction in positions from 83 that it would appear, but we are no longer counting our certified teaching staff in the position count. So that is accounts for most of the reduction that you're looking at.
Before we go into questions, I'd like an explanation of your capital budget of $15 million, just a brief one.
That's okay. The next on our list, and maybe, Allison, why don't you go through with a presentation that is the governor's budget?
Okay.
I think you have that in your bill, Mr. Chairman, and that might be helpful if you had that page in front of you, if you've got it available. If you have it, turn it up.
It's on page 46 of the appropriations bill, Mr. Chairman. The first priority of the department is a problem that has become very apparent in the school districts with asbestos. There are several school districts that have done quite a bit of work on asbestos identification in the schools. We have cost estimates from the Anchorage School District that would that they would need $10 million to remove their asbestos in the schools that they've identified. Fairbanks is looking at approximately a $2 million request. This $5 million is unidentified in terms of exactly where we would use it. If it was appropriated as a pot and no other funding was identified, it would be on a first-come, first-served basis. But we are aware that the problem is much bigger than just that $5 million would represent. The state ownership of school sites, $500,000, is a problem that we are looking at in rural areas primarily, where schools are sitting on land that does not belong to the state. It's either land that has been transferred, it has got some clear interest, whether it be a lease interest or actual ownership of the sites. The Tabelic consent decree are the final schools that have been identified to be met under the original Tabelic consent decree. There are several schools included in that $3.8 million. And just running through them briefly, in Yukon Flats, Birch Creek, $250,000, Chalkeetsik, $250,000, Stevens Village, $500,000. In the Lower Yukon School District, Russian Mission, $500,000, Hooper Bay, $600,000. The Lower Kuskokwim School District, Oscarville, $275,000, Aleutian Region School District, False Pass, $785,000, Accutan, $677,000. And one thing to alert you to in this area is that in most of these cases, the school districts have requested funding above and beyond what is required under the Tabelic consent decree, because many of the facilities they're looking at need additional work. So when you look at the capital budget priority list, many of the requests for those school districts are in excess of what's required under the Tabelic consent decree for other purposes. Learn Alaska ITV materials production, this would provide funding for Alaska-specific productions. CIP planning grants would enable the department to provide some upfront planning money to the REAAs, who have no other avenue to obtain planning funds in developing their CIP requests. Under Education, Information, and Cultural Services, the first request is the $2 million for the second phase purchase of the Shelton Jackson Museum collection. Acquisitions money for the state museums at $175,000. Libraries trying to implement an automated circulation system. That would cost $360,000. The State Arts Council has a proposal for CIP grants, equipment grants, to their arts constituents, and that is a $100,000 grant program. $430,000 for library acquisition, and $500,000 for a public library construction matching grant program, which was approved in legislation but has not yet been funded. Adult and vocational education, these three requests are all at the Seward Skills Center. Purchase of training equipment, $940,000. Repair and major maintenance of the facilities at Seward, $600,000. And $500,000, which would provide planning and design money for a Voc Tech Center dormitory.
That's the total of the budget as far as we're concerned.
The Post-Secondary Commission is here to address their portion of the education program, if you'd like to hear from them.
We're going to have a few questions with you, then we can call them up. The first one I have is under the foundation program. I don't think we have no problems with Donbay schools and the BIA schools and enrollment growth. Tell me, under the cost of living adjustments, how did the department come up with 4%?
The statute is rather specific that the Anchorage area increase will be the base for that increase, and it will be a January to January figure. And this is an estimate of what that January to January figure will be. I don't believe it's final yet. Isn't that correct, Allison?
We don't have the final figure. We're already aware that it's going to exceed 4%.
Okay, so you're using the Anchorage Consumer Index urban.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
We did that, Mr. Chairman, because it really directs us to do that. There are some things that are wrong with it, just on the surface of it. There was an unusually strange occurrence last year that in January it took a dip. And the dip only for a month or two. Now, that extends or expands the increase that's going to be necessary at the end of the year, as you can see. And I think this is a question that you all are going to have to wrestle with. But what we've given you is the best estimate of what it will be when that figure is final. But it is an estimate, and it is in accordance with the statutes as they're providing.
The next question is the school bond debt service is going to be about $95 million this
year.
Yes, sir. That's not going to be showing here. It'll be in the front of the operating budget.
That's correct.
Cigarette tax that you get, and it's been in the past that has been between $7 million and $7.5 million, but the last 2 years it's been down in the neighborhood of $2.5 million. What's the reason?
The historical amount, Mr. Chairman, is $2.5 million. We had 1 year where the fund had been allowed to build up over a period of years. And the $7 million figure was the year that we chose to appropriate the balance of the fund. But $2.5 million is an accurate reflection of the annual collections.
Thank you. Representative Grusendorf.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very interested in your concern about the Anchorage Consumer Price Index there. One question I have here for my understanding of the school foundation program. You discussed here the enrollment growth in the urban and rural areas. How much increase would this be dollar-wise? Do you have that broken down? You said that you could break it down. It would be available. I know that
we can provide it unless Allison has it right off. We could break down where the 46 comes from.
I know the chairman of the finance subcommittee will get that, but yeah. I'm just kind of curious to see.
In terms of, as a ballpark number, the enrollment growth in total was about $9.5 million. And I don't have a breakdown between how much of that was attributable to urban and rural.
We can provide that, though, the whole detail of how we get the total of 46.
Fine. Your particular subcommittee has been delegated to Representative Furness along with Mike Miller of North Pole and Representative Larson. So that's who you'll be working with the subcommittee putting the budget together.
Representative
Larson?
Proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late at both committee hearings here at the same time. Commissioner, the major concern I've heard, which was kind of surprising since the beginning of the session, is one of the programs that I have in the university budget and one of the programs that Mr. Furness will have in his budget. And analyzing both of them, I'm not quite sure if legislators can adjust the problem without the two major departments getting together. This has to do with Loan Alaska. Now, I know that the administration got rid of hot potato, which was nice, but we also noticed that they didn't give you the money. They kept most of it and justified it for public broadcast and for some other reasons. So I don't know if we gained or lost there. However, I noticed that some of these same appropriations are requested in the university budget.
I personally feel it's about time we put it in one agency, and maybe DOE is the natural agency. And if you want additional services from UA to help you in productions or technology or whatever, maybe that's about it should be. But instead of three departments, now we have it down to two departments. And Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to suggest that maybe the administration and the two heads get together and put it in one department so that legislators today and in the future can tell who's doing what. And I work very hard with Mr. Furness on that, and unless we have the same fiscal analysis expert, Mary Lou, something wrong there. It's very costly. I also hear complaints from the royal communities, again, which somewhat surprised me, but not necessarily that much, that they really don't think they're getting the money's worth. Most of them don't want to watch it. They'd rather have something else on that channel. I know in Anchorage area I have 8 channels, and I'm switching around all the time. When things are so bad, I finally put on Channel 7, but sometimes they have great shows. But it's more or less because the others are so bad. In royal communities, they don't seem to have that selection. But the popularity of it when it was sold in 1980 and 81 has not materialized, and I think we had to evaluate that very much. Also, in the fishing technology, we noticed that there's a very hefty increase from the university on fishing technology, and they again are talking about the Seward program, also the Kodiak program, and statewide. And I feel again that maybe there's a duplication of service, maybe you all know what each other's doing, but from a legislator's point of view, it looks like there may be duplications. And if you could solve that problem for both our committees, I think it would be very helpful.
In the matter of where in Alaska, Mr. Representative, we'd be more than happy to try to work towards a single administrative head. There may be some problems with that. The university has a good deal more latitude once you've appropriated funds to it than we do, and has been very much more able to respond to lacks and so forth. One piece of an answer. Second, we're at a plateau stage in the development of Learn Alaska, and we're going to find out how really effective it is for teaching purposes, and we're right at that point where teachers this year are tuning in, using, utilizing it more than they ever have in the past. The thing about nipping it or worrying about that at the moment is that the whole thing could be nipped at a level below where it ultimately can achieve, if that makes any sense, in that we don't think it's had enough time yet for the programming to be utilized. I fully understand your observation about Anchorage, but I think the fundamental nature of Learn Alaska from the Department of Education standpoint is an outreach to rural areas that do not have the advantages that an Anchorage would have, although it's available to Anchorage just as well. On the matter of the fisheries, we are communicating about those two programs. I could not respond to you at this point as to whether or not the costs which you identify are the result of overlapping and misuse in the sense of not having had it well organized. But I know that the programs are integrated now between Seward and the university, and they seem to be in pretty... As a matter of fact, the two men most responsible for providing those programs are working very closely together and have turned out to be very close friends, sharing a good many of the same kinds of interests and backgrounds. So the answer is yes to both of your suggestions regarding better efforts administratively. That is, yes, we're willing to try it. I think there may be some advantages as well as disadvantages.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Allison, I'd have somebody here from the Post-Secondary Education Commission.
My name is Paul Gallius. I'm Director of Administration for the Post-Secondary Commission. And this is Ms. Jane Maynard, who is Director of Special Programs for the Commission. I'd like to begin by addressing the various components and briefly describing what the components of the Commission are involved with and mentioning staffing levels and the budget request. There are several components within the Commission. One is titled General Administration, and there are 11 staff members in this particular component. These 11 staff members are comprised of 5 professionals and 6 support staff. They are engaged in administering the basic programs that the Commission is charged to administer. These would include the Veterans State Approval Agency function, which essentially is federally funded, and we anticipate that we'll receive about $109,000 in federal funds in this particular category. That incidentally supports program approvals for approximately 1,100 to 1,200 veterans in various institutions, on-the-job training programs, and apprenticeship programs in the state of Alaska, scattered throughout the state of Alaska. The Commission General Administration side also administers the school licensing law, Alaska Statute 1448, which requires that every post-secondary institution in the state be authorized to operate, or in other words, licensed by the Commission. Currently, that list is comprised of about 35 institutions, each of which must have an on-site review conducted by a team with the original authorization and also with the renewal process that goes along with the authorization. The General Administration also provides administrative support for the State Educational Incentive Grant Program, which is a program that affords modest grants to student applicants who can support and demonstrate a need for such funds. We anticipate, this is indeed a separate component, and we'll address that in a moment, but we anticipate that we will be receiving, approximately $120,000 in federal funds this coming year, with which the state must match on a one-to-one basis. Support is afforded by those monies to approximately, Jane, you have to actually help me out on that one. How many students?
We're supporting about 120 students this year with that grant money.
Normally, there was an item, as you look at your budget documents, you'll see an item in there that was labeled as $200,000 in the grants category. That was money that was allocated for a community service and continuing education program, which was also administered through our agency, and it was money that was washed through the agency, given to various communities and eligible institutions to conduct training programs emphasized at leadership development, management type skills, and those sorts of things in local communities. The total agency employs, and I'd like to skip now to the administration of the student loan program, if I may, unless there are questions on the administration, the general administration. The total agency employs 59 employees, 11 of which have been identified as the general administration, and the other 48 are associated with the administration of the student loan program. These 48 people are involved with giving the initial awards, monitoring the student loan applicants as they go through their various programs, monitoring the deferment year and the various, or the grace year period and the various deferments that they are eligible for, and eventually putting them on a repayment schedule and monitoring them at the repayment schedule. The repayment staff are also enhanced by a collection section within the administration of the student loan program, and this is a group of 7 people that, to put it bluntly, chase the people that don't make their payments regularly. Estimating what the worth of each of our individuals are, we've done some cost estimates on it, and I can say that each repayment clerk that we have brings in the neighborhood of $600,000 to $800,000 a year as recovery for money from people who've had student loans in the past, and each collections person brings in somewhere in between $200,000 to $400,000 a year. collections, of course, is a much more cumbersome, tedious operation than routine repayments. At the current funding level, the governor's recommendation is that we more or less maintain status quo at the current funding level for the student loan program. This, however, is not going to allow us to operate at the optimum efficiency because, as you folks know from the past, the student loan program is just growing by leaps and bounds. Every year, of course, we are authorized to give out so many loans, and eventually those loans do become mature and get into the repayment cycle. And this is the aspect of the administration of the student loan program that is indeed growing very rapidly. I would refer you now to your booklet that I just distributed for you. And under the tab marked Student Loans, I'd like to point out the growth of the student loan program. The tab marked Student Loans begins with a program description, page 2, a page 3, a page 4, various statistics, a page 5, and a sixth page in from there is the chart marked Table 1 that I'd like the committee members to refer to, please. The line that you see drawn between 1982-83 and 83-84 is a delineation between what is actual and true in past history and that which is projected to the best of our ability. If you look at the third column, you'll see that the loan volume anticipated to be distributed based upon loan award demand is going to increase somewhat over the next several years, and it will eventually stabilize. But the real effect of the growth of the program is going to be felt over in the fourth column, which is titled Cumulative Total. You'll see that this year, at the end of this last year, actually, we had approximately $150 million out in outstanding loans. At the end of this year, that figure is going to jump to $218 million. And in the years coming, it's eventually going to approach the neighborhood of $600-700 million. And that's not too many years away, if the program continues to grow this way. What this means is that collections is going to be an ever-increasing administrative burden that has to have the proper attention given to it. Otherwise, there just aren't going to be any collections, let's face it, to put it bluntly. And I guess what I'm saying to you gentlemen is that we have the statistics, we know the money that has been given away as loans, and we know that we're going to have to collect it because it is indeed a loan program, and the amount of effort and the manpower and the resources that are dedicated to that collection effort are going to determine how successful we'll be in the future. We have had our default rate down, speaking of this collections area, we've had our default rate down as low as a little bit higher than 8%. Right now, at this moment, it is hovering somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 to 11.5%. And I would predict that by the end of this fiscal year, it's probably going to be close to 15%, somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 to 15%. Now, that's getting borderline. That is attention seeking. Next year it's going to be worse. Next year we have another 8,000 accounts that we anticipate going into repayments. And with the same staffing level, with the same dollar resources allocated towards the collection effort, it's going to be extremely difficult to maintain a viable collections effort. I realize what I sound like and relating this information to you, but I feel obligated to do so. It is my responsibility to point it out to you. The program undoubtedly will get attention one way or the other, either through the success or the non-success of our collection efforts. That, in a nutshell, is the student loan program. We have several other components within our total budget. The Wichita administration is a modest sum of money. It's $58,300. All of that is committed to the Wichita Consortium. None of it is allocated to our state administration. The actual administration of the program is conducted by Ms. Jane Maynard, in addition with her other duties. The Wichita Student Exchange Program is currently recommended by the governor for $1,716,000 this year. We anticipate that for the actual demand placed on the Wichita Student Exchange Program, it'll be closer to $2 million as opposed to what has been recommended. This means, of course, that if the funding level comes in less than demand, the commission will indeed place priorities on who gets funded and in what increments. And we're fully prepared to do that. I've already mentioned the student incentive grant program, and this is a very modest sum. It's a one-to-one match, federal dollars and state dollars, and the money does go to needy students, and as the title indicates, it's an incentive for the student to attend an institution of higher education. I just merely mentioned the other component called data and word processing, and that was a requirement that would be broken out this year. Those funds would normally have been distributed between various components, administrative components. I've run over my time, so I'll cease my comments at this point and ask if there are any questions.
Thank you. We did receive this booklet in the mail to all the legislative writers, which just not too long ago. Yes, I've read that. Yeah, Representative Gusenow?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a heavy question, but under the WICHE section, you have certain areas where Alaskan students can, you know, apply for the program. And I was in discussion with, I believe it was Kerry Romsberg, not too long ago, in relation with petrochemical engineering. And he said, well, it'd have to be a statutory change. And then we kicked it around. He says, no, it fit within the criteria, and it could be one of those. Why is that not on that list, being that it's a very important part of the future of the state of Alaska?
I'll defer to Ms. Jay Maynard, our expert in Wichita, on that one.
There is a Wichita Mineral Engineering Program, which enables the students interested in pursuing chemical engineering at the undergraduate level to do so in six different states at in-state tuition rates. At the graduate level, in order to include that as a field, it would have to first be approved by the Western Compact of the 13 states, and then it would have to pass our legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Representative Michael?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three major questions. Number one, on the default rate, I've expressed these feelings before with the post-secondary, but I think it needs to be expressed now. It seems like over the past 3 or 4 years, the Commission has been using the default rate in two major ways. One, when we want to sound good, we use it by student per student default rate, and that usually gets us down to about 9% student loan per loan default. But the real meat of the problem is money. How much money are we losing year by year? And then when we want to put forth a disaster picture, then we say we're going up to 14-15%. And I think that we have to be consistent so that legislators or anyone will be able to tell what is really happening. Maybe both figures should be analyzed, not only the student per student default rate, but also the dollar per dollar rate, and we will be able to say what's really happening. I'm not sure it's what we have here in item number 7. Is this head counting or is this actual dollars long?
Those are actual dollar volumes, Representative Martin.
We're down in dollars now at 9.1 for 82-83.
Yes, sir.
And you suspect in the near future or now we're at 15%?
No, right now we're about 11, somewhere at 11.5% area, and we're forecasting that if things go the way they are in terms of accounts going into repayments and so on, we'll probably be up around 14-15% by the end of this fiscal year, and those are indeed dollar figures.
Dollar figures, thank you.
Sir.
The other concern I have was an analysis, and I think it's very important for everyone to judge what is a fair loan to a student, and we've done a fair job here on tabulating what it costs a student on various campuses on and off. The one that strikes me that's rather unusual is the differences between people second page to the last. Between UAA and ACC, they're the campuses that are right next to each other, and the major campuses anyway. But yet, ACC students need almost $700 more to go to school than UAA, and that doesn't seem rational to me. I don't know why.
It seems like ACC students have more calls for housing. They live in the same neighborhood, and they also have more calls for travel, and they travel the same distance. Most AC students go near to nearby high school. I was wondering if the commission would later analyze that better, because there may be some rationale for it. Maybe that's the better ACC students should be told go UAA is cheaper, you know.
These are figures, as you know, sir, that are supplied to us by the schools themselves, and they are indeed budget figures that we accept on face value. But your question is certainly a good one. It'd be interesting to find out why the big difference.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you very much for your time. Welcome, Jim. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's take care of Department of Education. So we'll start with Department of Natural Resources. Commissioner?
Chairman and members of the committee. We're happy to give you an overview today of the Department of Natural Resources budget. We are, as members of this committee know, one of the largest land managers in the United States. In addition to our 33,000 miles of tidelands and 10 million acres of water over which we have management responsibility, our upland acreage owned by the state has now reached 77 million acres. This is an increase of 13% in the last 12 months. We rank just behind the Bureau of Land Management and the National Forest Service nationwide as the largest land management agency in the United States. We are furnishing you with details of the achievements of the department over the past 12 months. I feel it's our responsibility to report back to you what we have accomplished in the last year. And today we would like to talk with you about our fiscal 85 budget. Governor Sheffield has proposed an operating budget of $63.6 million for this department, a capital budget of $19 million, and a loan budget of $14 million. And as this committee knows, our operating capital and loan budget requests are intimately interrelated. So our overview, organized under the three fundamental goals that we see for the department, that is meeting our fundamental responsibilities as landowner and preparing for wise decisions with respect to those lands, and a larger goal of assuring the economic vitality of the state and the quality of life of Alaskans through our management of the state's estate. All of these we hope to achieve through these three budgets. With respect to our fundamental obligations as manager of Alaska's lands and waters, we are seeking increased funding to make progress in updating our land records so that transactions in land may safely take place, keep our recorder's offices open full days, and improve our services to the public, identify unsafe dams and take steps to assure that repairs are made, prepare responsible surface management of our lands, including action against unlawful users, oversight of sales of gravel and materials, assure that accurate and clear title documents on all lands transferred by the federal government to the state are obtained, reduce backlogs in issuing contracts to land purchasers, plan for and provide sound management of the Kenai River, and review and resolve issues of state selections, navigability, and native allotments. In addition, we hope to negotiate and complete some major and minor land exchanges in the coming year and promote timely reforestation of some of the state's lands in South Central and Interior Alaska. With respect to achievements, we hope to obtain under our second responsibility of preparing for resource decision making. we are proposing essentially continuation funding in that regard. We will continue to conduct a stable and balanced resource inventory program through geological investigations and mapping, carry out inventories of soil, timber, and archaeological and historic resources, and participate with the public in planning for future land uses. We feel strongly that these resources belong to the public at large and that we have an obligation to involve the public in the decisions that are made. With respect to our larger goal of assuring economic vitality and quality of life, we are seeking increased funding in fiscal 85, which will improve efficiencies in permitting procedures, which will allow petroleum exploration to proceed more expeditiously, to encourage future mineral development through our newly established Division of Mining, enhance visitor satisfaction with state parks and waysides through improved maintenance and support of our most heavily used parks, and this through the establishment of concession operations at some locations. In addition, we want to increase the success of Alaska's farmers and ranchers through electricity and road access for areas that are now under development, assistance with crop insurance premiums, and low-interest loans for both large and small-scale agricultural development, and provide assistance to planning for large-scale development projects. We feel that we can help assure these programs through conducting 3 oil and gas leases on state lands in the coming year, entering into royalty oil contracts that provide premium payments to the state and contribute employment within the state, encourage wood products industry through development of a management plan for our newest state forest, the Tanana Valley State Forest, and make lands available to Alaskans for residential and recreational uses through our land offering programs. We are reflected in the administration's budget for $63.6 million in operating budget, $19 million in capital improvement budget, and $14 million in loans budget. I would like to reiterate again before closing and going into some specifics with you with Mary Halloran's assistance that our 3 budget submittals are closely tied together. Without seismic data, we cannot select appropriate bidding methods for oil and gas leasing. Without accurate up-to-date land record systems, we cannot engage in land transactions, whether they are exchanges or disposals. And without surveys, we cannot offer homesteads or subdivisions or small agricultural tracts. Without rehabilitation of the park facilities, we cannot ensure quality visitor services to Alaskans and tourists. And without reforestation, we cannot assure the growth of sufficient wood products for Alaska's timber industry. I think it's extremely important that our submittals be considered together, and all 3 of them are contributors to the major goals that I've described. You may look at our budget as doing 10 things, in that there are 10 categories under which our budget has been submitted to you with respect to the operating budget. Or you may look at it as doing 141 things, because that's the number of projects that are reflected in this budget. With your experience, you know as well as I the great diversity within the Department of Natural Resources. We feel that this last year we have been able to bring together diverse divisions within the department into an integrated system. The increases in budget that we're seeking that are reflected in the governor's budget are in the areas of land and water management, in the areas of information and records management, very homely, housekeeping, fundamental kinds of things if we're to be to obtain the state's estate and manage it properly, in the area of forest management and minerals and energy management, as well as parks and recreational management. This is a 7.7% increase over fiscal 84 adjusted base, and we feel that we are well represented in the governor's budget and appreciate the care and consideration that went into the development of our budget, both on the part of our own divisions and department, but also on the part of the Office of Management and Budget and the governor's office. I We'll turn now to Mary Halloran, whom you have known for many years, who is our Director of Management in the department, and ask her to provide some more specific information for your use before questioning.
As Mr. Warnocke has mentioned, the governor's budget as submitted to you does represent an increase of about 7.7% over the FY84 adjusted. The bulk of the money that we spend in DNR is spent on personal services. We are a field operation with offices in 35 different sites in the state. You will find in looking at the funding sources that we have experienced a potential decrease in federal funding for this next fiscal year due to changes in the United States Congress's attitude towards forestation efforts in the Maine. You'll also find that we have kept our position count basically constant. The increase in part-time and temporary employees that you'll notice in the position count is a reflection of our failure last session to get clear authorization for the youth employment program and the student intern program, although we had no doubts about what legislative intent was in those two areas, since they're very popular with the legislature. I don't have anything else in particular that we could give you. We'd be glad to respond about particular questions, particular programs.
Okay. I've got a question. It's under your BRU and natural resources. I think you've got some of these things backwards. Is you've gone down in minerals and energy development in the state of Alaska, and yet you've put a lot of money, more money into agriculture, agricultural loans, and capital. One of these days, when somebody evaluates and profit loss of the month, the money that we put into agriculture, it's going to cost every Alaskan $10 for a potato one of these days. And I think that you've got it backwards here somehow. And you've gone from your loans from last year, from your agriculture loans, from $10 million up to $13 million this year. What's happening?
This reflects the governor's program with respect to agriculture, Mr. Chairman. And I think the fundamental question that the governor was asking is whether it was possible to increase the amount of food supplies within the state for Alaska residents. I think he's also, and we too, are looking down the road toward the diversification of the state's economy in the future. You're quite correct that there have been increases in agriculture, and yet the minerals and energy management budget has remained rather stable. But one is would be more capital-intensive kind of budget than the other, and does reflect the desire on the part of the department to look toward the future to diversify the state's economy and to provide for in-state food supplies for Alaska residents.
I agree on diversifying the investments of the state of Alaska, but I think we're going at it backwards. I agree maybe it should be oil and gas, forestry, and tourism and that, but I don't think that you're going to find out for years to come that agriculture is going to be one of those diversified investments that has going to be a return to the residents here in the state of Alaska. I don't think so. Even if you see, if you read and pick up an article last month where a farming industry in California is going bankrupt, where they have good weather and they don't have any problems down there, usually, you know, but they're going bankrupt, and yet here in Alaska we have harsh conditions up here for agriculture.
So. Some of the position, too, that we find ourselves in, Mr. Chairman, with respect to that program, was picking up in the middle of things that had already been begun. And it seemed essential to us and essential to the governor to not just mark those off as a bad guess, but to recognize the investment in time and money that had been made by individuals who had already begun some of those programs.
I'm hoping that we're looking at the state as a whole and not using this particular issue as a political plum for something in the future. But I hope that it's an investment that we're going to look at.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
There's, as you noticed, there is about a 4% increase in the Ag BRU. The bulk of that, which is about $75,000, what we really did in Ag was reallocate funds in response to the report to the governor on agriculture policies. You'll find that $140,000 of that reallocation, which could also be represented as the increase, is the crop insurance program, and that bill, as I understand it, has passed out of the House Resources Committee and will soon land on your desk, and maybe Esther could talk to why we think that is particularly important.
The crop insurance legislation, the federal government pays 30% of the premiums on federal crop insurance, which leaves the farmer to pay 70%. The bills before the legislature would allow the state to pay another 30% of those premiums, leaving the farmer to pay 40%. In a way, we're insuring our own agricultural loans by the crop insurance legislation. So it seems fiscally sound for us to contribute to that and